Good morning, everyone. We are continuing with our series that we've had a couple weeks now on shining as lights in a troubled world. That theme, as we focus on what does it mean to be witnessing and living out the truth that we believe and affirm, both personally and as a church. And as we're just reminding ourselves each week, this is based on a couple of verses in Philippians where Paul says, do everything without complaining and arguing so that no one can criticize you. Live clean, innocent lives as children of God, shining light, bright lights in a world full of crooked and perverse people. Hold firmly to the word of life then. On the day of Christ's return, I will be proud that I did not run the race in vain and my work was not useless. Shining like bright lights in a world full of crooked and perverse people. And this is the third in my sort of opening trilogy. And I'm going to have a break for about a month, actually. So first one, we looked at the notions of personal worth and how our Western world invests a whole value system that actually tends to reinforce the position of the elite or the powerful or those with fame and celebrity. And we say how that is not a good value system to value our sense of who we are. The fact that we are loved by God and welcomed as a child of God is far more valuable and secure and rich a sense of worth. Then last week we looked at the positive side of friendship, committed friendships. It's often underestimated as something that is of value in something which can enrich us. And the third of my trilogy is looking at a Hebrew word I suspect most of any of you have not heard. But it's actually one of those rich gems of a term that comes when we begin to explore the Old Testament in particular. A culture of tov, that is to say, of good. Now, the reason I actually use that word intentionally, and I'm a bit wary about using too many Hebrew and Greek words and others, otherwise it becomes a bit overwhelming. But this one actually has got drawn to my attention. I was a bit familiar with it, but a book that was produced in about 2020 by an author that I have enormous respect for, Scott McKnight, is a great scholar, but also a great contemporary observer, and his daughter, Laura Barringer. And it's actually against the context of the number of significant large churches in North America in particular, though not limited to that, where culture of authoritarianism, of bullying, of abuse, and of failure was bringing enormous and continues, sadly, to bring enormous disrepute upon those churches, some of the really big-name churches with significant pastors. And over against that, and they ask the question, how is it that churches can slip into that space where there is many church members and members of staff talk about the toxicity of a church? So against that backdrop, they co-wrote this book called A Church Called Tov, based on this Hebrew word for good, forming a goodness culture that resists abuses of power and promotes healing. So I'm just being upfront. I'm drawing on their application of this theme in a very contemporary context. But I've done so fairly independently and something that I wanted to explore further as it is. There are two creation accounts in Genesis. Genesis chapter 1 has the big picture creation account of the heavens and the earth, the light and darkness and so on. And then the second creation account in Genesis chapter 2 sort of fills in what does that look like on the ground? What does it look like in the garden? The first account, you will see, has a shape behind it. And it's fairly familiar from anyone who's read it. It starts off, verse 4, God saw that the light was good. Then we go to verse 10, the next day of creation, God saw that it was good at the end of his day of creation. Verse 12, verse 18, verse 21, verse 25. Each day God surveys what he has done, looked at the result, and he says that result is good. That's the word tov. And then it comes to the culmination. the passage that we had just heard from Elaine. God saw that all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. That is the culmination. And that is this word, tov. Now, this word, like many Hebrew words, and not limited to Hebrew as well, no single English word really does it full justice. Good is a good way to render it. But it has the notion of rightness, of order, and of harmony. It's very closely associated with the word that I do use a lot, of shalom, the word that we describe as flourishing and as peace. That is to say, as God looks at what has resulted from his creative work, things are working as they were meant to. It's good, good for purpose. It's about things functioning according to its purpose within God's creation. That is why it is good. And what we are to take from that is that creation is good because it sustains life and relationships in this covenantal balance. God has committed himself to ensuring that this creation project will deliver. But we have a part to play. We collaborate in this creation project by tilling the soil and planting and being about cultivating what God has provided for us. So there's no way to read Genesis chapter 1 to view it as a static, perfect state. There's work to be done. There's the potential that God has given for it to be fruitful. When it adds the word exceedingly good, very good, it intensifies the pattern that has been said till now. It is good, it is good, it is good, until the last one. It is exceedingly good. And that notion has a sense of wholly or completely good. This is now as it should be. And by using that phrase, it suggests that completeness and culmination is this has been going somewhere. God's creation project has a plan. It's heading towards a goal, and it's well on path for that goal. All the elements in this creation project have now been provided. It's fit for purpose for what is intended to do. It is quite striking that in the second creation account, there's one phrase that it says, it's not good. Having had all that, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, of the first creation account, second creation account, it says, it's not good. And I'm sure you know what's not good. The earth creature, the man, is alone and he's not fit for purpose. Man by himself is not fit for the calling. So the woman is created to complement the man. So I'm just noticing how this term just is sewn into the texture of the narrative. So creation as a whole is now more than a sum of its parts. I've drawn on a few quotes here, some from authors over the years that I've actually picked and others that have just grabbed my attention. This one is from a Jewish scholar called Nahum Sana, and he writes in his commentary on Genesis, each element of creation is good in its own right, but together the whole is very good. The harmony of the interrelated parts working together in life-giving balance. That merits the term. It is exceedingly good. I think it's a really helpful observation. So we note that the phrase very good doesn't mean that it's finished or it is now perfect. Sometimes we have views of creation that are quite idealized, even romanticized. There's this pristine, perfect state, like a bit of wilderness that, you know, as long as humans don't come anywhere near it, is perfect. Trouble is that we have to go into those areas and we mess it up, and we've taken this pristine piece of nature and spoiled it in some way. Now, we certainly need to be responsible of how we inhabit that space, but we don't live right next to those pristine lakes. We don't live on mountaintops. We actually need to find places to inhabit, to create community, to find shelter, to be able to cook food and so on. It's never God's intention that I've created this pristine world and just, you know, steer clear of it. It's actually, no, it's there to be used, but to be used as God intends, not abused in or exploited. So here we have a picture of creation that is set on a trajectory of becoming. And that's one of those words that is actually really significant and helpful, but it can sound a bit cliched. In other words, this is not God's end point for creation. It's a project, it's a trajectory that is yet to reach the end point, the goal of what it is to become. And it'll only become that when together with God and the gifts that God has given and the way in which all the elements of creation work together, it produces the fruitfulness, the bounty, the flourishing that is designed for it to become. So, but it's poised for this ongoing relationship of growth of relationship, growth and freedom. Let's unpack that a little bit further. This is one that another scholar called Catherine Tanner, she's a theologian, and she's looking at a theology of creation, has this really helpful comment. The goodness of creation is the goodness of potential and promise, not of immobility. It's not a static state that can't be changed. That's the Greek idea of perfection. If something is perfect in the Greek world, don't do anything, because anything you do is going to make it less than perfect. But that's not what is on view here. This has got a life to it. And something that Tom Wright picks up, the scholar who's incredibly prolific in his writing, in his wonderful book, Surprised by Hope. If you haven't ever read Surprised by Hope, it's a great read. It's one of those rare books that actually starts, that finishes even better than it starts, and it starts well. But often, some books I find start well, they sort of squeeze out the tube of the toothpaste, and at the end, there's a sort of a little bit at the end. Tom Wright in this one actually really hits his stride in the last couple of chapters. The biblical vision of the world, Tom Wright says, as good, as tov, is not a static ideal, but a dynamic vocation. Creation is good because it's full of potential and purpose, waiting to be brought into fuller harmony through human stewardship. That's actually really, to say encouraging is actually an understatement. It's a profound sense. Because do you find sometimes people talk about, I want to really get into making a difference in the world, into ministry and all those sort of things. As one of my brothers, Jonathan, my late brother Jonathan, was a history master at Trinity Grammar in Sydney for about 35 years. And one of the younger ones had come through and had this big announcement to make over morning tea at the staff, morning tea area. And he says, oh, I've decided to do something meaningful for my life. I'm going to leave school and go to the ministry and train to get into, go to Moore College and all that stuff. And he wondered why it went down like a lead balloon for all the rest of the staff there, all the other teachers saying, so you're implying that we're not doing anything worthwhile. You've made this great career choice. And there's a danger in the sense that if you really want to do something different, you have to go into this ministry. And to realise that education and care and nurturing and building and being in the fields and doing all the different things that we do in life is no less part of God's calling for us. This is what it's saying here. Everything we do to contribute to the growth and the flourishing and the cultivation of creation is doing God's work, as God intends and calls us to do. Creation is good because it is full of potential and purpose, waiting to be brought into fuller harmony through human stewardship. And we all have a part to play in that. This word tov, this word good, also has ethical weight. It denotes something that is morally right, life-giving, and it is faithful to God's ways. Now, I'm sure if I asked you what does Micah 6:8 say? It talks about kindness, justice, mercy. Yeah. What I hadn't realised until I looked at it again, it actually starts with the word tov. What he has told you, mortal one, what is good? Tov. It's intriguing. And then the part we're more familiar with, what does the Lord require of you? That to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God. Tov, in the Hebrew sense, another scholar says, is always relational. Good is what promotes community, justice, and life. Evil is what destroys them. Now, without getting into all the metaphysics about evil and about Satan and all those other realms that are sort of, we never quite understand. I certainly don't understand it all because it goes into a space that is just above my pay grade. But a broad brush definition can be looked like this. Anything that is creative and builds up and cultivates things that are good and life-giving is of God. We'll come back to that in a minute. Everything that threatens that, that tears it apart, that destroys it, that is destructive, is not of God. Evil, by another word. That's which is destroying. That's not a bad way to view. What are we to make of all the things that are happening in the world around us? What is building up? What is bringing peace? What is bringing our flourishing and well-being and safety? That is good. What is actually causing destruction and devastation and causing death and disease and fret? That is evil. That is not good. And it needs to stop. So, coming back to this book by Scott McKnight and Laura Bassinger. They've actually had a follow-up book, or pivot, when they actually were asked, well, what does this actually look like? Can you give us some way to approach it? How can we change a culture in the church? One of the really interesting comments I came across last night is that they were saying, based on research, that you don't change culture overnight. You're not going to hear it just by hearing a sermon or two, even a trilogy, dare I say it. They say it actually takes about 7 years to change a culture in a church because it's all the accumulation of the little things that need to begin to come together and be addressed by it. So a couple of quotes from McKnight and Barringer, I think really quite striking. First of all, they echo that this trajectory of what is good emphasises that Tov then stands as a pattern for human community. This language of good and being very good becomes the model that we should aspire to. And when people sometimes tire of hearing prophets and things, you point out things that are not good, and that's the calling of a prophet, is to say, that's not good, that's not good. But when they say, actually, this is good, but you know what, we could do even better. Let's aspire for even better than just good enough. And that's actually not a bad notion because we can do better. None of us can say personally, as a church community to others, we've got it sorted. We've reached that very good space. No, hopefully before God, we're good, but we can do better. They said God's declaration of very good sets the tone for all of human life. Goodness, empathy, truth, and beauty are the design for creation. It's interesting that they wrote this, and this part I think is part that Scott McKnight wrote in particular, in the late, 2018, 2019, 2020. Since then, the language of empathy has become a hugely contentious one. There have been now two or three books written around the dangers of empathy. It's quite an extraordinary debate. Without going into great details, the biblical basis for the debate while saying that empathy might be a sin is, at an academic level, absolutely flimsy. It tries to distinguish between the words of empathy, sympathy, and compassion as though they're all significantly different terms, whereas they're a cluster of terms that are used intentionally in the New Testament precisely because the Greek and Roman world viewed them with suspicion. In fact, the language of the danger of empathy sounds alarmingly like the Stoics. This will get Dave excited, but no one else. The Stoics had a big thing about the dangers of being disturbed by other people's emotions, keeping them at a distance. Sounding a lot like some of the church in North America saying, that's a dangerous place to be. Don't get drawn into things where you might feel bad for others. Well, go figure. Sometimes we actually do need to feel bad for others and enter into the passion, the pain that they are in. Because that's precisely how Jesus is described. So, very good. Sets the tone, the model. Again, a couple of other quotes. When God pronounced creation good, he's saying it was beautiful. It was working properly. It was life. It is life-giving. And that is what a church should be. A community where goodness flows through every relationship and every decision. That is what we should aspire to be. And it doesn't just happen by accident. Again, another quote from their book. A culture of good doesn't just happen automatically. I've just said that. Here you go. It must be nurtured. It must form habits of goodness. Because tov is something we practice and grow into. So, let's take it a little bit further. Once we begin to look for it, we see this is written into our biblical narrative, and especially in the New Testament, everywhere we look. Whatever is good and perfect is a gift coming down to us from God our Father, who created all the lights in the heavens. Understand this, my dear brothers and sisters. You must be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. So James says in James chapter 1. So as I reflect on that passage, this is something we can choose to do. It doesn't just happen. To step away from narkiness and from grumpiness and being quick to judge or showing disrespect for others that may have different views to our own. All that impulse, that this is one that really jumped out on me because it's my boss, to default to critique or to criticise, to move from asking the question, where can I find fault in what someone has just said or what they are doing, but rather, what might I learn? Even though I may differ from them, even profoundly, I can still learn. Now, I suspect in some ways, we sit with that and think, is Tim having a go at me? No, I've got no one in my eyes. I'm just looking very generically. But as a church, this actually is a danger. And we need to name it as a danger. So I'm going to take a step of naming it in a way in which needs to be said, and you can come back at me and whatever. There is a danger of an older generation being precisely like this to a younger generation. And our media feed it up. The youth are out of control today. They just live for themselves. It's all about me. They're just indulgent. They just look at all this, this, and this, this. And I have all these conversations, and people say, well, youth are just dreadful. And then I go up to some of our schools, and I see our kids emerging with bright faces and a desire to make a difference and to do things that are so good. And I'm thinking, why don't we hear these stories? The danger can be, in a more senior church, as I would say, as a general demographic, that we think, oh, it's not like the old days when we knew how to do things. Younger generation, oh, it's not quite as good. Their music, it's all, oh, I don't get the music. I don't get this, I don't get that. They want to do this sort of stuff. And you know what happens? That younger generation says, look, we love you are there, like our grandparents, and we visit you occasionally as a church, but you're not living in our world. And they'll hold a distance. It is a cultural challenge for us to say, look, I might not agree with much that some of the younger generation want to do when it comes to worship or about the various things they get involved in, but what can we learn from them? and how can we encourage some of that early signs of what is good and promising and healthy, and to say some words of encouragement to it. I didn't bring the graphic up because I didn't want to go there too much, but there was that show a number of years ago of a grumpy old man, grumpy old woman. I didn't actually look at it. But there was that show, and it was just based around how these grumpy old people go around the villages and everything else and just complain about everything. It's all, what else? And it might be a bit of entertainment. I actually didn't find it that. But actually there is a Christian version of it that we need to be mindful of. We can choose not to be narky and to be grumpy and to be quick to judge and to ask some questions. What are some of the good that we can affirm, the things that we can discover are happening in and around us? So, this is from the biblical texts as a paraphrase, and I'll give you the text afterwards. As we look at the stream of things, the voices in our wider community, and it's just intensified through social media and from headlines that are designed to try and get our clicks to follow through on the story and all those things, we can choose to steer well clear of things that are bullying, that are forms of personal abuse, of hatred, and of negative caricatures, and especially demonization. I say that because I grieve what I see of some of the Western Church, especially in North America, who are blowing oxygen into those dreams and spiritualizing it. And it is shameful. And I think it'll implode. It'll be such that it can't have life because it's not of God. But language of bullying and abuse and naming people and demonizing them, the language of hatred, even to saying, well, it's all well and good to show some forgiveness to someone, but you know what the President of the United States said? I don't want to love my enemy, I want to hate them, any of my competitors. That is not good. Don't get drawn into it. Steer well clear of it. Turn it off. Is it biblical? Well, like Colossians 3, now is the time to get rid of anger and rage and malicious behaviour. Now is the time in the first century. It's still true today. Slander and dirty language. Colossians 3, verse 8. The positive one is, well, how do you clothe ourselves? How do we follow the way, the example of Christ? Colossians 3, again. Since God chose you to be the holy people he loves, you must clothe yourselves. And notice the language. Be tender-hearted. Tender-hearted mercy, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Make allowance for each other's faults and forgive anyone who offends you. Remember, the Lord forgave you, so you must forgive others. It's actually an imperative. It's a strong. Don't just take it as an optional extra. God expects it. Above all, clothe yourselves with love, which binds us together in perfect harmony. And let the peace that comes from Christ rule in your hearts. As members of one body, you are called to live in peace. Another version of it, which is what we had as our second reading. This is rightly a favourite passage for many people because it is a language of tov, a language that which is good. Paul says, and now, dear brothers and sisters, one final thing. If you're going to turn your mind off to all those negative things and those destructive things, this is what you should turn your mind into. Fill your mind with this stuff, not that other stuff that just draws us down. Fix your thoughts on what is true and honourable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about things that are excellent and worthy of praise. Keep putting into practice all you learned and received from me, everything you heard from me and saw me doing. Paul says, I'm not just telling you, I've tried to model this in my life. Then the peace of God will be with you. Let that shape our culture as a church. When people step into our doors and they spend time around our tables and coffee, and when they see us at work in the garden and other things, that people see something that is good and creative and encouraging and hope-filled. Well, that's the end of my trilogy. Thank you for your patience with it. Next week, I'm going to pass the baton in our little relay to Fiona, who's going to be picking up the theme of Shabbat. How do we intentionally make space to ensure that we recognise and enjoy the goodness of what God has? Then Paul's going to